Well, I wondered if anybody could write a play about the war in Afghanistan now. I think there would be an audience who would want to come and hear the argument. You know, it has to be something that has, or even, well, now wait a minute, Enron, you can't get into Enron, which is not, which happened in history, but you can't get a seat. And if anyone did anything on RBS, or people who retire with that kind of salary,
all the people who have even died today, I gather we've lost some more boys.
Well,
it's Remembrance Day.
We can't do a play about Afghanistan or Iraq or any of these places because it's us. There's no them, there's only us.
But if there's us in Jane's play.
Yes, there's us here, but in the world, now talking about the anti-war plays. We did Lovely War, it was fine, but there was still a Remembrance of the parade today. And boy, didn't it look beautiful. No, I do not disrespect the people who were killed in wars. God knows. But it looked stunning. And looked wonderful. The scarf, the uniform, the music. It looked beautiful. And it's time we stopped making it look beautiful. It's fucking dreadful.
Absolutely.
That's the rage we should have. I say absolutely. all the people who are amputees from the war should sign up to occasionally be allowed to sit in baskets on the Christmas decorations on Oxford Street or Regent Street and have a snarl at the traffic and we wouldn't have another war.
Yeah.
I've been to hospitals where there are people from the First World War and the Second World War. I used to go around and give talks and do me acts and bits and pieces. And they're all behind trees. They're all in houses. They're all in old country houses, hidden away. Hidden away. We have to accept the fact of the horrors in grandmother's lullabies. Don't play with a little Croat, don't play with a little Serb, don't play with a little Jew, a little nigger, a little pup. Don't play with those kiddies. We have to accept that, and we will not, because we cling to our culture, our flags, our poetry. There's only us. A baby is born now in China, it's a baby. A baby's born in America, it's a baby. What happens when they grow up? Brainwashed into believing in all sorts of crap. And we do it. Our lullabies. We aren't the old bourgeois. How beastly the bourgeois is, especially the male of the species, and watch it tramp for miles behind a little rubber ball and then watch it go soggy like a wet meringue when faced with a new life demand. D.H. Lawrence. That's what I feel, and it's never been done. And all our playwrights and all our theatres will take the position of this, and of course I can't bear it. I'm glad I'm 80 and I'm so soon out of this world. Soon out of it. I can't bear the hypocrisy and crap that we... I go around schools talking to kids. Now I can't. Because now, when you walk into a classroom, how much do you earn? But you've got a car, you bastard. How much have you got? There's no them. There's only us. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a bit more about the Furies?
Sorry, I
didn't. The Furies. Hold on to the Furies.
Listen to those lullabies.
And then next we'll take Polly's question from the front.
Okay.
I'm just quite interested to know where these people came from. You said they were hippies, and I know that Sheila said they came from all over around the country. I mean, did they want to be involved in theatre and in the arts, or did they just kind of get...
No. They got corralled. I mean, they hadn't the slightest interest in the theatre at all. They were interested in this building, which was an expression of not just theatre, you know, it was a social centre. They just got rounded up by us or so.
It does seem quite amazing because, I mean, just hearing the stage directions of all the things that they were asked to do in the course of this production, it's quite demanding for a trained performer, never mind for somebody who's just...
But some of these things that they did are invented by them.
Right.
Yeah.
You see, it wasn't do this,
right?
Is here we're all in a room together, and you develop your own being.
They did their comments on us.
Yeah, so they, a lot of these Furies where it says they had to be this, they had to be that, they didn't have to be anything. They had to invent what they were, you see. So that's why
It was such a democratic production, wasn't it? God,
my story.
Yeah.
And how long did this rehearse for? With the creative?
5 weeks.
5 weeks.
Oh. If
do you think?
If that.
Do you think a bit less?
Year four, I would imagine.
About 4 weeks?
Yes.
Can I ask a question? Just because it comes back, it's a little bit prosaic, but it comes back to what you're saying. You talk about the hippies and the Furies being quite anarchic. And you talk about having only the bare bones of the scripts.
Yeah.
And you talk about them bringing things, and Victor was talking earlier about improvising to a degree. And you rehearsed it for, well, was it improvised to a degree every night? Or was it more or less?
No, I think came the evening when it was to be performed, I think it was locked off. But the next day, changes could be made. But just to provide, just to survive each evening, you can't muck around once the thing rolls.
No, and technically, because I mean, I've noticed there's things like the fire rage where there are a lot of sound effects, but you had a lot of projection and a lot of telecine or whatever going on.
And it was time.
Although you may have been cueing it, it must have had to come up at the right point every
night. It did, exactly, yes.
And yet the whole, I mean, it's hard to say watching the production tonight, but what you don't get is that all the visual stuff and the sound effects and so on.
Sure.
And but that felt, it sounds like it's quite loose and quite, I mean, quite improvised and quite organic.
Well, in the control box, there were maybe 7 or 8 running the technical side.
Right, there was a major
seven or eight. In a control box as spacious as any television control room, and each one doing a separate thing. So it was tightly...
Yeah. So it was pinned down.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Polly was first, and then Mike, and then someone in here. So let's talk, Polly.
Well, first, just to say that, you know, talking about warfare, and I performed in a church hall once with a vicar at harvest time. He, instead of apples and oats and things like that, acorns, he had guns and grenades, because he said, this is what we have to offer these days.
This is what you back.
Yes, yeah. But back to the original experience of doing this play, which is, the material is, now the very writing of it is not familiar, but the material, the subject matter, is more familiar to us nowadays, 40 years on. But, although I think a new generation should see it again, you know, and some years later than this, myself. I was in London only from 1969, but I wasn't aware of this. But that's what he was saying, man and woman were saying, must have been for you. You obviously very progressive actors at the time, but it must have been quite startling as well to have to say those words, and as a man working with a woman working with a man.
Well, I can answer that. We had an attitude. We believed this. We could not act.
Oh, right.
The stuff.
But for the in front, presenting it to an audience.
Yes.
That would have been. I know the audience again would have been the kind of people who wanted to hear what you were trying to say.
More than words.
But.
I mean, I had already read Sylvia Plath, and at that time, I'd read Sylvia Plath before I met Jane, and at that time, I'd been given her first book of poetry, Ariel, first published book of poetry, Ariel, by the man I eventually married, and I just knew what she was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And the man I married actually sat his finals at university with Ted Hughes on one side and the editor of the New State, the to-be editor of the New Statesman on the other side. So, you know, it was interesting. And then I had another piece of luck. I was in a cafe on my own in Soho where you could get half a chicken and a loaf of bread for £5. And I was there on my own, and quite empty. And a man walked down the stairs And I just knew he was going to come and sit at my table. And there was lots and lots of tables. So he came over, he sat down. And I can't remember his name. He's this American. Anyway, he's a very famous American writer. And I'd seen his picture in paper. Said, I know who you are. He's an American. And he said, well, what are you? I said, well, I'm an actress, but I'm ill-read. He said, you want a reading list? And so he brought out this reading list. And on the top of which was the French philosopher whose book, opening lines in the book are, I think it's quoted in the film, the female child is not born, but made. So my mind was already turning by the time I met with Jane. I noticed a few things.
But then you see, a pacifist mind is not born. A woman is not born. We are totally brainwashed into believing absolute crap. That's what I believe.
Well, you're right.
You've got to get rid of it.
The question on would the audience come, you see, it's in your hands.
Yeah.
I mean, I've sat in on the actor's studio when Strasberg was still working there and alive and things, and I think he knew that there were some actors from England in.
Yeah.
So he quickly said one thing. He said, listen, the theatre of the future of the theatre is in your hands, not mine, I'm an old man. It's in your hands. You do it. And he's right. It is true. I mean, Joan worked on that principle.
Can we
Joan's
bring in another question? Because I'm very briefly at the time.
I saw it. I saw the Arts Lab, and I also actually briefly worked on the technical side of the Arts Lab, but after this show. I worked on the Alchemical Wedding, for those who remember, at the Royal Albert Hall. And I completely endorse and praise what you're saying. There was a spirit of the time that we all felt that the point of theatre was to change the world.
Yeah. I get sick of people saying, the 60s. It's the first time where the young spoke directly to the young without any intermediary.
And also, let's not forget that for those of you who don't know, in England, it was only 6 months before this show opened that we finally got rid of the Lord Chamberlain.
Oh, yes.
And that crap, which was a bunch of retired army majors. Preventing the playhouses of Britain discussing anything grown up for 300 years.
Yeah, right.
So the opportunity that these people took and made was quite important. But there was, I think, in the air, a spirit of potentiality that we could actually change the way the world happened and the way things happened.
What happened?
Well, I'm going to throw it back to you. Apart from, you know, the fall of socialism or whatever, or the Berlin Wall, made a matter of difference because everyone thought there could possibly be some socialist utopia. But what do you think happened, and can we get it back?
It's up to you. You see, when I said this earlier about the 60s, when people said, well, the 60s,
But
you see, it was, as I said before, the first time the young spoke directly to the young without any intermediary. We were doing that at the Arts Lab because we were beyond the bound. Why? It was amazing. It never happened. There's always an intermediary. There's always somebody telling us to lead us. You don't need leaders. It's us. You. Us. You don't need somebody to tell you about what's going to happen. And that's, unfortunately, what's happened is I was with the Beatles and I did all their films. I travelled around the world with them. And at one point we were in Salzburg and John said, hey, Vic, come and look at this. And as far as you could see out on this balcony, there were tens of thousands of Austrians, young Austrians. And the Beatles put, I haven't got a prop on me now. Oh dear. Put combs to their lips and all did. Let's get it, I need it, I want to get it. I think we can talk into speeches. And those young people laughed. It was the first time any laughter had happened about that ghastly man. It had to be stopped. Power structures were crumbling. Religion is now worried. The Pope is coming here because they're not making enough money to cover his pension plan. It's true. People knocked at the door the other day of my flat and said, we've come on behalf of St. Patrick's Church in Soho Square. I said, well, why? Are you Catholic? I said, no. Are you religious? I said, no. I said, I'm deeply spiritual.
He said, you pray, I said, every day. This is my temple, I pray every day, this is where I live. I said, where are the peacemakers? Where are your cardinals? They're worrying about their pensions and their pacemakers. Not about anything else. We give power to absolute arseholes. Then, also remember this. We are all born arseholes, because the first thing that's formed in the womb is the ring to get rid of waste matter. We are all born arseholes. Now let's start from there.
I suppose I'm about to return to the rather prosaic end of the matter, but I'm just old enough to remember what was happening in the 60s. In fact, I didn't see this particular play, but I do remember the Arts Lab. I was taken to it as a 13-year-old the year after in 1970, and I found it very daunting being a porte-bourgeois myself. But one of the things that was certainly present then was that everybody seemed to be interested in doing their thing. And what interests me is how the Arts Lab actually managed to continue to exist. This incredibly advanced technological and, it sounds to me, high manpower intensive production, for instance. How could you afford to do this?
We didn't,
like
we weren't
that?
Paid.
Exactly. Is that not one of the
things? That's great. Why do you worry about money? Stocks and shares and banks.
Go on, what is your point there?
My question is, how did you manage to do all this stuff? And it's not just the Arts Lab, it's the whole series of companies and alternative theatre that sprang up.
Joan Littlewood never had a grant.
Were we looking to earn money from it?
No.
No,
passion, yes.
Passion.
Therefore you raise the question of how on earth did we live if we weren't making money
exactly.
From what we're doing.
Yes.
Well, in my case, and in Victor's case, and in Sheila's case, this was a short burst of activity, let's call it 3 months. The rest of the year, we were earning money. Me as a film director, and Victor and Sheila as actors. I mean, we took a chunk of our lives out. And
that's
say,
right.
Fuck it, we don't need any money
that's
for this
right.
period of time. Everybody could do that.
Yeah, but now
everybody could give 3 months of their life to doing something other than which they do.
But my darling,
for nothing whatsoever.
I think one thing
you could live around, off what you could make in 9 months.
You go around schools now and they're all about what have you got, what you have. You go to drama colleges, they all want to know about when can they be famous.
Mm. Actually, the only problem was Sheila. She wanted a Bentley out of it and we failed.
What did you want? A bagel?
A Bentley.
A bagel you can have.
She wanted a midnight blue Bentley.
I've never owned a motor car in my life.
I take a Jaguar Dame.
I've never owned a
car.
One of the things that really comes through with doing unfinished history interviews and so on is you know, that there were a lot of hidden subsidies at the time, I think, which is that you know you could find spaces
well,
to
we
rent. Well, no, just in terms of there were spaces to rent which were cheap, where people could squat and they could live. I mean, this goes through the 70s and into the 80s, which hadn't been turned into luxury flats and so on. James talks in his interview about kind of going down to the vegetable market and getting the squashed vegetables or sometimes
but,
they got given or sometimes they got
But be mixed. Careful about
and
that.
And they made a pot of stew and the hippies, you know, the stew and people slept on people's floors. So there was that kind of subsidy that just came from the fact that those possibilities were there.
But be careful about that because I go around the country with plays and shows still working. And I find in some of the theatres who are grants, I'm not talking about the RSA, I was there for 18 months. I'm talking about grants, so I think, I'm talking about theatres around the country. They're all subsidised, they get money from the councils, and they're appalling. They've got 15 or 20 people on the payroll. When 3 people did it years ago, they've got an assistant director, publicity man, this, they've got a list, a whole list of people, all taking money out of that theatre.
There's 86 people on the roll at Stratford East.
That's right, 86.
I counted
when there was only four.
86 people.
That's what happens when you get a bureaucracy running anything.
I've got a question here. Nora, did you want to say something?
Well, I'm just saying, look, just be very careful when talking about the theatre as part of the entertainment industry, and I draw a line under industry, to suggest when there are so many theatres since, let's say, the 80s that were killed off, closed down, annihilated and demolished, that one cannot start saying that other people who have the supporting and contributory skills should not also have an equal place within their workplace, which includes actors, which includes what you are generalising upon, saying administration staff.
Ah, well, now wait a minute.
Maybe it's a big question for another time.
Well, yes, it is.
Because we're running out of time.
Yeah, that's why I'm saying.
86 people in Stratford East.
From this side, just to
add on to that, of course, the other thing that we used to have as actors was the doll. That was Armadillo. Yeah. That's on the bottom too, isn't it? Well, never mind. The thing that struck me when I was reading this script the first time was, you're a child of the 60s, I'm very pleased to say, it was the freedom, just the freedom, and maybe I'm kind of remembering that wrong, but I was comparing it with now, when we're all so terrified of causing any kind of offence to anybody, and I just thought that beautiful kind of blossoming of anything is possible, I will say what I want, I will get my badge out in front of whoever I like.
Power structures are threatened, that's why.
But the correctness wasn't in, was it?
No. No.
Political correctness, health and safety. The inhibitors hadn't taken over.
I'd just like to say that I worked at Theatre Workshop with Joan Littlewood in the 60s as well.
Right.
Not exactly at the same time as Victor. Yeah. And it was the most magical and astonishing place to be. And one of the things that I think we haven't said here at the moment is that the mid-60s to the late-60s was, Victor's touched on it, a very real can-do society.
Yes.
You know, it wasn't about having money at Theatre Workshop. You'd have a list of things that were required on stage, and you'd go and get them. You'd go to the Port of London Authority, you'd go to the docks, you'd go to the manufacturers nearby, and you would get everything required.
Yes.
You weren't asking for money. I think in all sorts of ways it's much harder now because the industry isn't there and a lot of the infrastructure isn't there. But the can-do attitude doesn't seem to be there.
We're all takers now, darling. Well, we're all takers. If you really want something, you really want something, you give it away.
Yes. We've got three more questions to comments to fit in. I think first one is the one with the blue on.
Yes, Maya.
Yeah.
I want to say that I bought this play 20 years ago as a drama student, and I just loved listening to what you were saying about being in it. And I just want to ask you, what did you take from it? Because I've been really inspired listening to you. It's so experimental. Nothing. I don't believe it for a second. No. But being in that, you've talked already, Victor, about that, and them inspiring you as plays you're in. So what I'm interested in, what you personally felt, Sheila and Victor, and Jack, about what did you, what's the one thing you've got from being in this experimental
I could do anything.
Thing?
Yes.
You could do anything.
I felt I could do anything.
Yeah, that's right.
It's worth a try.
I go around drama colleges sometimes talking when I'm asked, and I say to them, don't go to the theatre because you want something, go to the theatre because you might have something to give.
Wow.
They want things now. Mm. We're all a wanting society. Look, let things go. If you really want something, give it away. If you want love, give it. If you want joy, give it. If you want interest, give it. If you want intelligence, give it. Those are the things that are worth keeping. And if you give them away, they're yours forever.
Jack, respond.
Your want.
What did you take away from it?
Ooh,
shut up.
Get off.
I mean, I walked into it. My aim of doing it was to help Jim stop this place from being closed down. There was this massive celebration of how to work together with the three of us and all the wonderful people we were with. But I wasn't thinking, my God, isn't it wonderful we were able to communicate this all? I expected it. I thought that's how the world was. And I carried on thinking that way for a very long time. I think it was, wasn't until the 80s that I realized kind of somewhere I hated England. I really hated the place.
All countries of dogs be dying.
And I detected it was probably much more difficult to do things like we dreamed of and did. But it's, you know, and I was born into the, not born into, I'm a film director, but I had a lunch in New York with Louis Malle, who'd seen a picture I'd made, and invited me to lunch, and he said, unfortunately, Jack, you're born in the wrong country. If you were in my country, and born into that, with the way you shoot, you'd never be looking for a penny, they'd be throwing it at you. In your country, which is Philistinism personified, you're in trouble. And you know what? I think you're right.
Right.
Yeah. Spot on.
Another question at the back, sir.
I just felt like, because everyone was speaking about how there's no contemporary can-do attitude, I just thought I should let you know that the award you were talking about with Peter Brook, the Anti-Space Award,
yes,
went to the Forest Fringe, who
yes
are run by 10 volunteers. Nobody's paid a penny.
I know.
I mean, there is still... There
and
there
are young people who have theatre groups around the country, and they all get support, they all get encouragement, it's marvelous.
It's, yeah, I mean, so I just think it's important not to forget that there's still stuff going on. You know, people, there is still a can-do attitude.
Right. I'm Gerald.
Yeah, I mean, I just actually wanted to say something similar. Because I agree with sort of everything that's come from you up there and applaud it, but just to bear witness that there are a lot of people, they're at the margins, they're not anywhere near the mainstream, but who still work for nothing, and most of the interesting work is done by people who work for
that's
nothing,
right,
or
yeah
very little.
That's right.
And they're still doing it, and you
yeah
keep running across people with amazing...
Well, give us a bell
ideas
and we'll come and help them.
Well, I mean, I, but they also they do what you
we're up,
what
they
do
up for it.
They struggle themselves and they suffer themselves. And it's still going on, but it's always
at
the edge.
At the drama schools, I mean, I've not made any money. I live on whatever I get. I'm not a rich man, but I'm not saying that because poor me. I don't give a shit what I earn, it's what I spend and what I live on.
Yeah, exactly.
And I've never been in stocks and shares and buying all this crap. When I go to drama colleges, I say, don't go there into a acting because you want something.
Yeah.
If you want something, you've had it.
Yeah.
Go in because you have something to give.
And
even if you're doing something you love doing. God, I'm lucky. I've been able to do all my life something I love doing.
Yeah. I mean, think drama
that's
quite
yeah
a narrow
yeah
agenda.
Okay. I think we're going to have to wrap it up now. I'd like to first of all say a plug for our project, Anthony Ministry, which is largely a voluntary project. We would like it to be a less voluntary project because it is a real struggle, actually. You can do great work, but it's also very hard to kind of continue to do great work on a voluntary basis, on an ongoing basis. So if anybody knows anybody rich or on the panels of foundations or who'd like to sponsor an Anthony History Project or would like to write a check or chuck a few coins in a bucket on the way out, then we're always very grateful for any support we can get. It'd be great if it was large, but we don't know any bankers, unfortunately. Please help support the project because it's really important we keep capturing the recordings we're doing, the interviews we're doing with people who are involved in the alternative theatre movement. And particularly so, earlier last year we interviewed Noel Gregg, the playwright, who died in September of this year. So we're hugely pleased that we managed to record a wonderful five-hour interview with him, which is going to be preserved in the archive for the future, so that his incredible experience in a whole range of companies, from Gay Sweatshop and the General Will and so on, that's been recorded. So please support the project. I'd like to say thank you very much to the panel.